This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For a lot of us, getting a traffic ticket can be a little more than an annoyance that results in a very manageable cost. But for some people, even the small fines for a broken taillight or a moving violation can snowball into massive bills once court fees are tacked on. And if you can't pay, those minor transgressions can lead to a revoked license and even jail time. For the poor, court fees are big money. Christina Becker is a criminal justice debt fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina. She's been looking into the system of legal fees and fines that have turned poverty into a penalty, and she joins me now. Welcome, Christina.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Give me a sense of what's going on here. We're talking about fines, fees, surcharges. I mean, these are people who have been accused of some kind of wrongdoing, right?
Yes, that's correct. So fines tend to occur post-conviction. So that's once they've been, after they've been charged, after they've been convicted, and fines and fees tend to be part of the sentence.
All right. And so explain how that works. Maybe you can give me an illustration of how this becomes a cycle that people find that they can't get out of.
Absolutely. And it really could happen to anybody if they're sort of in a precarious position financially. So, for example, I'm going to use you as an example. You get a speeding ticket, perhaps a speeding and a expired registration ticket. Fairly normal for most of us. You go into the court system. You don't have an attorney in North Carolina because if you don't face jail time based on that particular charge, you are not entitled to an attorney in the state, despite the fact that you could face jail time, you know, later on down the line, as I'll talk about. So you plead guilty to both of the charges, and what comes from that is possibly about $400 to $500 in court costs. Now, one thing I'd like to point out is that the fine and fees are two separate things. The fines, as defined by the state, are the punishment portion. So those are the things that the state says, this is what you've done wrong, and this is what we think that you should pay for it. Well, the fines tend to be much, much smaller than the fees themselves. Now, the fees are usually administrative, what makes sort of the court systems and facilities go. So although your speeding ticket might just be $25, the fees will be $200+. And so if you can't pay those fees in within about 40 days' time, now you can have a warrant issued for your arrest. You can be picked up at your work. You can be picked up at home on the street. And then you find yourself in jail, not only still owing the fines and fees, but now you also are facing bail.
Yeah, right. So now I'm in jail. And to get out of there, I would need to raise bail.
Right.
But I've already said I can't pay the $250, so coming up with bail is going to be pretty rough. And in some cases, I'm not even allowed to get a bail bondsman, which would be, you know, maybe 10% of the total cost down. You're saying in some cases, judges insist on the entire fee, right, or the entire amount of the bail.
That's right. And what we're seeing throughout North Carolina and multiple jurisdictions is that once you are arrested for non-payment of fines and fees without even being able to explain why you haven't been able to pay, you find yourself in jail and the bail is set at the same amount that you owe to the court. So if your fines and fees are $500 and your bail is set at cash $500, which means that you're not eligible to get a bondsman, and you have to come up with $5 cash. You can't get help.
$500 cash, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, and let's talk about that for just a second. Now we're going to move on to bail. We've talked about the fine. We've talked about the fees and perhaps surcharges, and now we're facing bail. But I thought bail was not supposed to be punitive. In other words, why would it be set on the amount that you owe? That seems to be somewhat discriminatory, based on a discrimination or a distinction based on the crime and not your likelihood of appearing for trial.
That is correct. It is unconstitutional to set bail as such. And so what's happening is when you pay that $500, then when you go back to court for your next court hearing to answer for the fines and fees, that bail that then gets converted to payment directly to the court. So you don't even have a say to where that money goes.
And of course, you had a hard time raising the money, so maybe you'll stay in jail, which of course may, well, maybe you can use an example, because obviously you stay there long enough, you're going to lose your job.
That's correct.
All right. And then you're not going to be able to pay anybody anything. Give us an example or two. I know that you talked about, for instance, a single mom in Robeson County.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about her.
Well, part of my work has been observing in four different counties across the state, and one of those counties is Robeson County. And there are a couple examples that I found were particularly egregious there. So the one that you're referencing was a woman that came in that only owed fines and fees for a misdemeanor charge. And I think it was around $700 or $800, so pretty significant. And she was a single mother. And she told the judge that she could not pay the fines and fees. He did not ask her what her income situation is. He did not ask her why she couldn't pay. He just wanted money that day. And he said, well, you're going to have to find out how to pay today. Otherwise, you're not walking out of this court without handcuffs on. And so she called her mom and friends to see if they could come up with the money. What she ended up having to do was pay out of her rent money. So right after that court hearing, she was going to go to her landlord and pay her rent money. And she was a single mom of two kids. And she said to the judge, I have to pay out of my rent money. And he said, yeah, you have the money. She said, no, but now I don't know what I'm going to do about housing. And he said, yes, I told you had the money. And she walked out crying.
In that case, is there any other recourse apart from that judge to demonstrate your inability to pay and to come up with some other system of payment rather than the $800 on the spot out of your rent money, which quite obviously, if you haven't noticed, threatens her shelter. She may be
Absolutely.
Thrown out of her house, which makes it very difficult to get a job, which makes it very difficult. Anyway,
right.
So is there a process in place?
Well, I think the problem is that that's where the statutes in North Carolina fall short. What they're supposed to do by law under the Constitution is have an ability to pay hearing. So if you can't pay, the judge should be asking, why didn't you pay? Can you tell me about your financial circumstances? And we know that based on what I've seen, that is just not happening. They're just have essentially become debt collectors for the state, and they're trying to drag as much money out of them as possible. Those hearings aren't happening, and the proper determinations aren't happening, even if there is a hearing. So another example would be also in Robeson County, where a man didn't pay his fines and fees, showed up for his hearing in a full body cast. The reason why he couldn't pay, he was working as a construction worker. He was hit by a truck and was in a full body cast. His spine had been severed, and he showed up in a wheelchair and said, I cannot work, and I probably will never be able to work again, and I'm waiting for disability. Well, the defense attorney forced him to have an ability to pay hearing, which he usually didn't do, and found that he willfully did not pay his court costs. So he's saying, I think you have the money, but you're just purposefully not paying, and put the man in full body cast and handcuffs and put him in jail that day.
There was a hearing, a process by which he was this. You made some kind of a judgment and
right.
under those circumstances. And of course, in the first case, you talked about it in the second case, a lawyer who insisted on that hearing, the single mom who's about to lose her home is not in a position to challenge a judge and say, I'm going to take this to court. This will not stand. Right?
That's right.
You can't fight that. Well, all right. So you've given us two examples. How widespread is this, though?
It's very widespread. And even though I've only been in four counties, I've talked to defense attorneys and other counties around the state that you just have to say, I have to ask what's happening with fines and fees. And you kind of get a small chuckle because everyone knows what's happening. You know, the constitutional processes are not in place. No one cares about due process. What they care about is saying to the state, look what I've done for you. I've collected this money for you.
Where does the money go?
So the money goes to multiple different places. If you look at the general court costs for, say, a misdemeanor charge, someone pays approximately $188. About $147.50 out of that, so about 75%, goes to the state general fund. So that goes into this abyss of a fund, mm-hmm. and we can't track the money afterwards. So we don't really know what they're doing with it. But then other than that, about 15 to 20 different government entities also collect from this pot. And one of those is law enforcement retirement, law enforcement training, facilities fees. There's a $250 fee just for community service. So for the to get the pleasure of performing free labor, you also have to pay $250 for that.
Well, you talked about the general fund, law enforcement, the courts. I mean, all of these go to fund programs that we think we need and are important, the general fund. But this money comes, the general fund, for instance, comes from tax revenues, largely. So it's interesting, if you cut taxes on the wealthy, as we've done in this state, and corporations, and then you have to make that up, it sounds like we're extracting more and more from people who have less and less ability to pay in order to keep financing our own just normal operations.
Absolutely. And, you know, the court system is a public benefit. And but the legislature is not treating it that way. It becomes more of a pay-to-play system. And so, therefore, people are paying for their own prosecutions after being dragged in there by the state. So it's not sustainable.
I've got only about 30 seconds left, but judges had been able to grant waivers in certain conditions if they saw it was clear you couldn't pay. The legislature has made that harder, I understand.
Absolutely, in two ways. One, that they passed a provision that tracks all of individual judges and their names, and all of those names are then reported to this General Assembly, so they know they're being watched. And the second way is that now they have to give opportunity and notice to be heard to all those 15 to 20 different entities that I just named, and give them opportunity to be heard and say, hey, go to these ability to pay hearings and say, hey, I want my money. Wow. You shouldn't waive these costs.
Christina Becker is criminal justice staff fellow at the ACLU of North Carolina. Christina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Got more details at our website, stateofthings.org. And we'll continue our conversation with American law professor Peter Edelman, who has written a book on this very subject. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's not against the law to be poor. That would be ridiculous. And yet, poor people in this country are disproportionately criminalized for the inability to pay. The money bail system that throws indigent people in jail when they can't buy their way out is one example, but there are many, many more. Peter Edelman has spent a long career in law and politics examining the policies that affect people who are poor. He's the author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. He's also a law and public policy professor and faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown University's Law Center. And Peter Edelman joins us now. Welcome to the program. Great to
have you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been thinking about this for a long time and have had a distinguished career. You were an advisor to Senator Robert Kennedy in the 1960s. Take us back. Tell us about the thinking about crime and poverty back then.
We did a lot in the 1960s, reduced poverty from 22% down to 11%, and African-American poverty down from the 50s down to the 30s for a lot of reasons, a lot of it connected to the civil rights movement and some of it public policy. So those were a time, but you know, what we did do stays with us. If we didn't have, and we're having a big debate about this right now in Washington, as you know, if we were to cut these things like SNAP, food stamps, and other things, it would hurt a lot because we would have twice as much people than 43 million that we have now. It would be over 90 million people if we didn't have those things. So we did a lot of things that stay with us. And the problems we have now is because of what's happened to the economy in our country. Now, something that else obviously connects to poverty now is mass incarceration and what we're talking about here with my book on the fines and fees. And that's different from the 1960s. The country started to do mass incarceration in the 70s, very political, very related to racial politics at the time, along with welfare issues. And so that's been a change in terms of the pressures on public policy.
And there was an understanding that there was a correlation between poverty and crime, and that to alleviate crime, poverty might well bring down crime rates. Was there not that sort of connection in the public policy mindset?
Absolutely. There are a lot of reasons why we don't want people to be poor. We want them to have jobs and have a life. But one of the things, if we can reduce poverty, we clearly will have less. Now, we also have very serious issues in the criminal justice system itself. But reducing poverty is clearly a part of what we need to do.
Well, and many of those were evident in the report on Ferguson when that report was released about the criminalization of the poor. And that's something that you looked at as you put your book together. Remind us about that report.
Well, we know, of course, the first tragedy, awfulness, was the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, and which woke us up with regard to that side of things. And we know how many, unfortunately, terrible killings of African-American men who were unarmed. But in Ferguson, when people started looking at it further, they also found that there was this, it seemed, kind of oddness that Ferguson was arresting all of its people over and over again. They didn't have a tax base, and they had turned to arresting these people and squeeze them for money, and that's how they got revenue. And then the U.S. Department of Justice, of course, under President Obama, made an inquiry investigation nationally and found, and many journalists had and many lawyers had, but it wasn't nationally visible, that what was going on and is going on in Ferguson is all over the country. And you might think it's mostly in the South. No, it's across the North, across the West, heavily about taking away driver's licenses. And so turns out that Ferguson was really gone crazy.
Well, you open your book in your introduction. You start with the story of a woman named Vera Cheeks. Tell us her story, because I think that illustrates a lot of what we're talking about.
Well, Vera Cheeks, who I talked to, and I got to her because she had a lawyer, and when people have a lawyer, it goes much better for them. But Ms. Cheeks rolled through a stop sign, as many of us do, and so she was hauled in, and she couldn't pay the amount that they wanted. And in their particular case, they didn't just throw her into jail. They said, "Oh, you go into another door," which meant they were going into a bogus in Georgia's for-profit probation. And she suddenly owed three times as much money just by walking in through that door because she was so-called now on probation. And so she was outraged by it. She wouldn't pay it. They were about to put her in jail. She had her fiancé was there, and they hocked their engagement ring, and so she got out for then. But she would have had a payment plan. She wouldn't have been able to pay at some point or another. She would have been thrown into jail. And fortunately, she found Sarah Garrity from the Southern Center on Human Rights.
But you need a lawyer, and that's the point, as so many other people in the country are brought through this system. And, of course, the courts and the people who put them through it, the prosecutors, all know they can't protest this. They're going to be in jail, first of all. And if they ever do get out, they're going to be kind of making, trying to figure out how to pay back these bills.
That's absolutely true. And so we don't have enough lawyers to represent everybody in those situations. And indeed, in too many parts of our country, the public defender is actually on a contract from a municipal judge and isn't a real public defender at all. It really is somebody who's working for the judge. And so that's number one, is we need a lot more representation. But we also need to take these things at scale. And if they put people in jail when they can't pay and there hasn't been an effort to find out whether they can pay, I mean a good faith effort at that, then one can get rid of in a wholesale way. And indeed, for her Ms. Cheeks, they were able to knock it out for the whole county once they were representing her.
Well, talk about this. You talk about a private probation system. And, of course, that means you have to pay to be on probation.
Yes, yes.
How does that work and how widespread is that?
Well, it turns out it isn't. It's 13 states that have for-profit probation. And, of course, you've got for-profit in prisons and all over the place, the medical services in jails. And it's really quite awful. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. For example, North Carolina doesn't have much of that, but the probation is still $40 a month when you're paying among the many, many fees that you have in North Carolina. And as you go around the country, you find that there are these enormous fees, regardless of whether it's the regular, if you will, probation agency is also charging in 44 states is charging to be on probation or parole.
You know, I'm going to stop you right there because I want to imagine this picture. If you're talking about parole, for instance, now let's talk about someone who's just been released from prison. They will have an appointment with their parole officer probably within a month. And I know in the state of North Carolina, you have to come up with $40 at that meeting. You've just been released from prison. You have a felony record. It's going to be pretty hard for you to find a job. And you got to come up with at least $40 at the end of the month. And I'm wondering if the parole officer wonders where the money came from. The first question is, do you have a job? And your answer is no.
Makes no sense.
What are you expecting this individual to do? If this
it's the system. I don't know what's going on in the so-called parole officer's mind, but he or she is certainly not being helpful.
They're part of a system. They can't buck that, right? They can't
say, I'm going to let you go.
But,
what happens? This person hasn't found a job. Maybe the family can help. Maybe not. If they can, it's the way they got the money is they didn't pay the utility bill they sold some plasma or something. It's just crazy. And it's really, really national. I was talking to people in San Francisco recently, and, you know, the bluest of the blue places, and they discovered that they had a bunch of these same awful fees, not just from the state, but from the county as well. And one piece of it there was the probation, which you not only had to pay $50 a month, but you had to pay 3 years of it before anything happens. It makes no sense.
And, of course, if you don't, then there's this downward spiral, right? And also, that at some point, you can lose your driver's license, which is something that happens at an astonishing rate here in North Carolina.
North Carolina's kind of up there. It's 1.2 million people, about 10%, I think, of your adult people who could be drivers are suspended. California was 4%, 4 million at their peak, but they're coming down now. The legislature is fixing that.
But forgive me for interrupting. Yeah. Suspended licenses, are some of these punitive? In other words, you lost your license because of some infraction? Or are you talking strictly about people who couldn't pay and because the debts, you didn't pay in time, and so the next level now is losing license?
The number of people who actually did something that was dangerous to the rest of us who and should lose their driver's license, very small.
So most of them, it's an added punishment for the failure to pay the previous fines.
The estimate here in North Carolina is about 90%
of one.
It's two things. They amount to the same thing. You have court debt, like we were just talking about, and you can't pay it. So the next thing they do, and it has nothing to do with traffic, or if it is with your car, it's a broken taillight. And they take away the license, either for not being able to pay or failure to appear. They sort of go together. And it's all over the country. I mean, going on my book, I've places I hadn't gone to, Massachusetts, Michigan, Wisconsin, over and over again, Oregon. I would go and I'd talk to the lawyers there. Well, do you have the driver's license? It's a big deal there. Oh, absolutely. Let me tell you.
And bail is the other part of this and another big part of this. Talk about how that system works, because to some extent, the court really wants to know you're going to show up. The system has been put up some money, and that's some guarantee to us that you're going to show up.
Well, there are ways of doing that that don't have to involve holding people in jail. And we have it now. A number of states have done reform that way and municipalities. So we know that it works to have the Arnold Foundation has developed a way with careful research on knowing what traits or what situations will allow somebody to be released on recognizance. And we now know from them that they have 93-94% success. So we don't have to be holding people who these are for minor little things. 65% of people here in North Carolina who are in jails, not the prisons, in jail, they're not guilty of anything. They haven't gone before a judge to be tried. And it's that way as you go around the country, whether it's Rikers Island and New York and all over the country. So what's going out? Two things. One is in the fines and fees game. What you do is you use the bail where the person can't pay and the family can't help. And so what they want and what they get is the person pleads. Guilty, even though they're innocent. So then they owe some money, and they get a payment plan, and it's got all these fees that you have in North Carolina, and all these other states have them too, and that gets the money pours in, and then when they can't pay, they get more because they get if they haven't paid, then that's criminal contempt and et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it piles up. So that's a sort of narrower, big deal, but that's the narrower piece. The bigger piece is the courts don't have enough judges to try everybody. And so the point of bail is to make sure that they won't ever come to trial because they haven't got the capacity to have a trial. So that's why they're squeezing people.
How does that work? That because you're trying to force a plea,
yeah, exactly.
In other words. Because otherwise you could hold them in jail and wait for the trial. But you're saying, no, that doesn't. I can't go to jail. It's easier for me to plead guilty,
exactly,
to a crime.
And that's the big
commit.
Problem about bail.
Is there, and we talked about this too, because it's a fee system. So part of it is just a kind of negligence and perhaps lack of concern for the mm-hmm. people who are affected by this. But there is money involved, and it does seem like states like North Carolina are using the money to fund their general fund, which would allow for a reduction in taxes on people who are maybe better able to pay. Cut their taxes. Where are we going to get the money? Let's put this guy in jail.
That's right. That's right. Now, the fact is, it's not good policy, but you could get me and you for $1,000, and I can come up with it. I think that's bad public policy, but I can do it. And but there is a kind of another attitude going on here, which you know, the people who are stuck in this way are disproportionately African American, and in other states also Latino. So it isn't only about getting the money. There's something else going on there as well.
Do you think it's a conscious form of racism, or just being able to take advantage of people who don't have the ability or the voice in our current social milieu, political
some of both? But if you go around the country, particularly in rural areas, but not only, you find judges who are really mean. And really mean definitely goes along with race, with people African American and Latino. So it isn't, I'm doing this because I got to do this. It's there's a racial aspect going on at well. Recently in Houston, there was a big lawsuit about money bail. And it was found in Harris County, Texas, that the whole system was unconstitutional, and we're waiting for that to go through the courts. But the point I'm making on your question is the people, they had this on film because they didn't bring them to court. They were all on Skype. And so you had pictures of these mean judges and how they treated people, and especially people with disabilities. But they're overwhelmingly African-American and Latino. So that's got to be a part of this.
And it is unconstitutional at some level. You talked about one case. Is there much of a challenge to this kind of behavior?
Yes, it's growing. There are people on the fines and fees who are putting together a much more systematic network to take on the fines and fees, especially where there is a constitutional question. There's that Supreme Court case of Bearden versus Georgia. But on the new thing in just the last couple of years is on the bail. And that Harris County thing, there are 12 of those around the country, 12 or so. And the biggest one was just 2 weeks in California, where the middle-level appellate court ruled that the under state court, state constitution, that the entire bail system of California is unconstitutional. Wow.
What about the courts and fees? Because you see, and I wonder what the trend is, because you would think there'd be a move to dismantle this system once these excesses and injustices are known. But here in North Carolina, they're doubling down and actually helping to enable it by making it hard on judges to even waive these fees.
Yes. Well, they're making it hard on finding out ability to pay here. There's some movement in North Carolina, in particular counties, on bail, and that there's some hope in that. You know, anybody who's got sort of any common sense about all this and isn't stuck with maybe the politics of the thing, they're actually wasting money. If you get people out on recognizance, you don't have to lock them up. Locking them up costs a lot of money.
Unless you have a private system.
And it's more painful. If you're running the jail.
The county jails are all on the public.
Yeah.
So what's the trend nationally? Is it more like North Carolina doubling down, or is there really a mind to reform?
No, I think that North Carolina is really in the bad column, really seriously in the bad column. And we've seen in Mississippi recently, they let out 100,000 people who had had their driver's license taken away, and the state let them out. So in the Houston case that I mentioned, which is a bail case, with the injunction that there is 6,000 people got out of jail. So there's stuff going on around the country.
Peter Edelman, author of Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America, also a professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at the Georgetown University Law School. Peter, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Peter Edelman's going to be speaking about the book Friday morning in Durham at a special event celebrating the 50th anniversary of MDC. He's also going to speak at noon Friday in Raleigh, and we've got all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to talk about the Great Durham Pun Championship this weekend. Please stay tuned.